order, please. And Justice Carson, you are here on 145. We'll go ahead and do a public hearing on Senate Bill 145 then. You bet. Ring whomever.
The kids go up there, go see him. We have to go up there and we'll beat up car.
It's getting late in the session, so keeping our attention is somewhat difficult.
Here. Yes, I'm sorry.
We have the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court here. You're a member of the bar, so I thought maybe you ought to pay attention.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wally Carson. I'm the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and I'm here primarily to introduce some of the people from whom you will be hearing this afternoon. Last session, we were asked to, by legislation, to put together a commission on public defense services, which was done, and I must say that with a great deal of pride and lack of modesty, I did a pretty good job. I did a very good job of selecting members of the commission, and you'll hear from some of them today. You'll first hear from Barnes Ellis, who's in private practice in Portland. He's a lawyer up there, and I tell the story. He was on the, it's factual, he was on the original commission on the judicial branch, chair of that, some 20, 25 years ago. And one of its elements was to move the indigent defense from the county level to the state level. And so under the rubric that no good deed should go unpunished, I asked him to chair this commission, which he has done splendidly. And you'll also hear from Ross Shepard, who's Lane County Defender Services down in Eugene. A second panel will be David Groom, State Public Defender, and Ann Christian, who is the Director of Indigent Defense Services Division for the State Court Administrator's Office. And then there'll be a third following presentation, a brief presentation, by Diana Stewart, who is now a member of the Oregon State Bar Judicial Administration Committee, but did serve on the Oregon State Bar's Indigent Defense Task Force 3, and she'll be talking, I think, about some of the quality issues as a result of that study. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. You'll get a brief review of Senate Bill 145 and then followed with Senate Bill 80, if that's all right with the chair and the committee.
Thank you, sir.
All right. I'll turn it over to Mr. Ellis, please.
Thank you, Chief Justice Carson, Chairman Minnis, and members of the committee. At the conclusion of the 1999 legislative session, the legislature enacted an amended version of House Bill 3598, creating the Public Defense Services Commission. This commission was established in the judicial branch with members to be appointed by the Chief Justice for the purpose of studying our entire system of public defense and to make recommendations to strengthen and improve the system. The persons appointed to serve on this commission have included two advisory members from the legislature, Senator Kate Brown and former Representative Larry Wells. In addition, the commission included a district attorney, two former legislators, a judge, two public members, and three representatives from trial-level defense provider organizations. I have had the honor and privilege of serving as chair of the commission. My own background in the field has not been as a practitioner, but as a participant in the formation in 1970 and longtime chairman of the Board of Trustees of Metropolitan Public Defender Services, Inc., a nonprofit defense provider in Multnomah and Washington counties. As Chief Justice Carson mentioned, I also was appointed by Governor Attia as chair of the Judicial Branch Commission, which recommended legislation that reorganized the administration of our court system and which provided for the assumption by the state in 1983 of responsibility for indigent defense, which previously had been handled in a very fragmented way at the county level. During the past year, our commission has held 10 days of fact-gathering meetings at different locations around the state and has received direct testimony from some 55 presenters knowledgeable in the field. These have included the Attorney General, several district attorneys, appellate and trial-level judges, national experts in the field, service providers in the specialized areas of juvenile law, post-conviction relief, and capital punishment cases, the federal public defender, and a number of practitioners in the field. In October, we met jointly with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and the Oregon State Bar Task Force on Indigent Defense. We then spent 3 days in work sessions leading to the preparation and markup of proposed legislation, which is SB 145 and its amendments. I would like to particularly acknowledge the contribution of the Commission's work of Chief Justice Carson, who not only attended all of our meetings, but was an active contributor throughout. In addition, I would like to acknowledge the contribution of Ann Christian, who is currently the individual within the State Court Administrator's Office that has been principally engaged in this area. We are in the process of preparing our final report as required by HB 3598, but appreciate this opportunity to outline for you today some of our findings, conclusions, and recommendations. The current system for provision of indigent defense services has emerged over the 27 years since Gideon against Wainwright was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, and over the 17 years since the state assumed this responsibility. It is a fragmented, unplanned structure. There are currently two state agencies involved in the area. One is the current Office of State Public Defender, headed by David Groom, which is a state agency that directly provides the bulk of the criminal indigent appellate services through full-time state-employed attorneys. That group is overseen by a five-person committee appointed by the Supreme Court. By contrast, trial-level services and all civil appeals, such as termination of parental rights and mental commitment appeals, are provided through a system of contracts and individual appointments, with the contracts entered into and administered by the Indigent Defense Program within the State Court Administrator's Office. There is currently a wide range of providers of trial-level services, including large nonprofit providers, consortia of law firms that contract on a bulk basis in some areas, private law firms that contract on a bulk basis, and individual attorneys that are compensated on an hourly basis for particular cases. By far, the fastest growing segment has been in the area of juvenile delinquency and dependency cases, and the related area of termination of parental rights cases. For example, the number of indigent defense termination of parental rights cases, for which the law requires the appointment of separate attorneys to represent indigent parents and children who are the subject of the proceeding, has increased 348% since 1990. The caseload for dependency cases has increased 304% in the last 10 years. In addition, there are specialized areas of post-conviction relief cases, death penalty cases, and mental commitment cases. I think it might be of interest for you to note that of the 162,000 cases that the Indigent Defense Fund is responsible for, only 53% are what you would think of as traditional criminals. 19% are child abuse, 6% are juvenile, 18% are probation, 1% is civil commitment. So it's a little different mix than I think many people have assumed. Our state has been a pioneer and leader in recognizing that our adversary legal system simply cannot function in any of these areas without competent defense counsel. Neither judges nor juries can perform their roles if they are not presented with facts and legal arguments developed by competent counsel on both sides. Fundamental fairness requires that no one's life or liberty be threatened without due process of law, and in our system, that necessarily requires competent counsel. Our conclusion is that the system that has emerged during these past 17 years is working, but just barely. To be truthful, it is a system that in large part is subsidized by the providers, whose compensation levels, for example, in the metropolitan Portland area, averages 24% below their peers in prosecutors' offices and 40% below comparable federal standards. Many younger lawyers who would like to practice in this field cannot afford to do so because of the heavy burden of educational debt. And while we believe that the most cost-effective system would encourage experienced career defenders, we found substantial evidence that many of the best lawyers in this field are forced to leave it for economic reasons, just at the point that their contributions would be the greatest. We heard testimony that in some areas of the state, particularly in eastern Oregon, there is increasing difficulty in attracting a new generation of lawyers to this field. Among the areas that we heard considerable testimony that improvement is needed is in post-conviction relief cases, which have been made particularly difficult to staff because of prison location decisions, and death penalty cases, which, quite properly in view of the potential sentence, require substantial cost to assure fairness. A difficult issue in this area is to preserve the proper level of neutrality of judges in criminal and other indigent defense cases. Many judges have felt that there is an inherent, or at least apparent, or appearance of conflict of interest inherent in their role in the current system, in which they generally select, appoint, evaluate, and approve the compensation and expenses for attorneys on one side of a case in which they are expected to be neutral arbiters. Another perceived, if not actual, conflict felt by a number of the judges is the fear that other elements of the judicial department's budget are penalized because that budget is combined with a large and growing indigent defense budget over which they have little or no control. The size of the indigent defense budget is a function largely of decisions or circumstances not in the control of courts or administrators, i.e., the number of criminal offenses, crimes committed, charging decisions, and the like. The legislation which we are proposing deals with restructuring how defense services are managed and provided. While we believe this proposal will resolve some of the conflicts I have mentioned and rationalize the administrative structure, no system in this area will work without adequate funding. And I might pause and say one of the sources of testimony we took were members of a commission that was formed in 1985 to 87 in this area. It was an experiment that failed, and they said uniformly the reason was they were underfunded by about $25 million, and no system can function under those circumstances. The structure we are proposing would keep public defense within the judicial branch, but not within the judicial department. The current fragmented system would be consolidated into a single Office of Public Defense Services with a director appointed and supervised by a seven-person commission whose membership would be designated by the Chief Justice, who would serve as an ex officio non-voting member. The commission would include not less than two public members and individuals experienced in both prosecution and defense. To avoid conflicts of interest, persons primarily engaged in state-compensated defense work would not be eligible. The commission would have responsibility for adopting rules determining the standards for financial eligibility, but application would continue to be a court function. The commission would review and approve all public defense services contracts. The new Public Defense Services Director would head an office that will combine the current State Public Defender Appellate Group, as well as those portions of the State Court Administrator's Office that currently handle this function. At the outset, the new agency will continue the direct provision of appellate services and provide defense services at the trial level through contract arrangements. We expect that over time, the new commission and director will establish systems for greater accountability and peer support that simply have not been possible within the budget constraints and fragmented structure under which the system has been operating. Our expectation is that some areas of practice will be best served by full-time state employed counsel particularly in the areas of post-conviction relief and in death penalty cases. We also expect that over time, more communities will be best served by nonprofit public defender offices similar to those now operating in Multnomah, Washington, and Lane counties. The Commission concluded that those offices provide a level of supervision, training, quality control, and accountability that is difficult to assure with individual practitioners or consortium arrangements. We also expect that the new Commission and Director will work to encourage retention of career path defenders and avoid a system that is merely a training ground for inexperienced attorneys at the expense of those whose liberty or other substantial rights, such as one's parental rights, is in jeopardy. The new system would also consolidate all decisions on expense requests in administrative rather than judicial hands, which would provide greater consistency, control, and accountability, and avoid some of the conflicts felt by the judges. We do not recommend that this state convert now to a FTE state employee system, such as states like Colorado have done. In our view, the contract system that has evolved is a somewhat unique Oregon hybrid solution to the problem and permits a range of options that better match the range of circumstances in our diverse state. We expect to continue some portion of the service through traditional court-appointed counsel, which can quickly adjust to sudden increases in demand without requiring permanent staffing at peak period levels. And as I have mentioned, the new commission and director will have to deal with the explosive growth in the juvenile delinquency, dependency, termination of parental rights cases. I was particularly pleased that during the course of our proceedings, we received substantial support from the district attorney's community and the Office of the Attorney General. One of our members, Brad Berry, is the district attorney for Yamhill County. I believe the principal reason for this support is that the DAs recognize that their own work will be made easier in a system that has competent and experienced defense attorneys, ones who recognize those cases that have issues that should be tried, and those cases where trial may not be the best option for the defendant. In addition, I believe the professional prosecutors in this state recognize that their first duty is not simply to gain more convictions, but to see that cases are disposed of in a just and respect for the due process of law. In summary, the key points in favor of SB 145 are the following. To create a structure that will provide better stewardship of the resources of the state that must be expended to meet its due process requirements, to provide better accountability and peer support among providers, to provide a system that maintains consistent statewide standards, but is flexible enough to match our diverse geographical needs and the ebb and flow of cases. Thank you, and we'd be happy to respond to questions the committee may have.
Mr. Ellis, I'm having a hard time understanding how this is really different than what we currently do.
What we currently do is fragmented and at a lower level. You have a component of the state court administrator's office handling contract administration. You have a separate office reporting to a committee that handles the FTE group that provides the appellate services. And you have all of that in the judicial branch and part of the judicial department. This would consolidate those pieces and separate them within the judicial branch.
All right. And we assume then that we get greater efficiency and greater supervision, greater stewardship.
That's certainly the expectation.
Okay. How is it envisioned that that would be accomplished in terms of leadership?
Well, I think one key to it is the combination of a commission of people who really do care to see that this function be supervised properly, and you would consolidate considerably more strength at the executive director level of the commission. What we have right now is more kind of an administration that's done remarkably well with the resources and the structure they've been given, but that's really been dependent on the goodwill of the people involved, and I think this has a far better chance over time of being an effective provider.
All right. Justice Carson?
you agree? I assume that you, if I'm reading the bill correctly, you're going to be appointing the members?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. And I had, over the last few years, tried to persuade the legislature in moving it out of the judicial branch for the reasons that Chairman Barnes Ellis explained. This is a reasonable accommodation, and it's not so much of me, but they'd like to keep the Chief Justice involved. I think that's an appropriate way. They put me on the commission, and or put my position on the commission, and with my concurrence, it's a non-voting, but it will be a member of the commission will always be the Chief Justice who will have input onto the commission. This is substantially different than from the 85-87 to which Mr. Ellis referred, and it has my full support. Senate Bill 145.
I'm wondering, how is it envisioned that this committee or group would relate to the Legislative Assembly? And you know, because you've been here before, the questions are always, why does it cost so much? And are we going to be able to get better information or more clear information?
My hope would be, yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my hope would be that you would get better information. That's a function of how many staff you have to gather the information and to sort it and then be able to timely report it back. My hope is that within this program there are increases in staff, and we will have the staff to be able to do it, as I would certainly second Mr. Ellis's comments about the wonderful job that Ann Christian, our director, has done with rather limited resources.
And I didn't want to infer that there's a problem. I think that
it's very difficult to
quantify those questions that you get in the legislature. I mean, I know kind of intuitively as a police officer that when you arrest people, there's
something else happens.
Expense costs that go along with that. That kind of happens, but it's hard to quantify. And I think the report, Mr. Ellis, your testimony indicates that there are areas of image defense that are growing at a more rapid rate than others. And That's very helpful. I guess one of the things that I've alluded to a couple of times in other bills is we don't have a comprehensive statewide criminal justice planning entity in the state of Oregon. This really isn't it either, but it seems to me that at some point maybe we ought to have some dialogue about how that might come together, because, again, Mr. Ellison.
I would support that. I think one of the things that prosecutors, judges, and defense lawyers all realize is they're part of a single system, and what one does directly impacts what happens to the others. I think we've made good progress in communications within, but some kind of overall planning group I think would be extremely helpful.
Well, I'm in the latter years of my career in the police bureau,
right,
so I can say these kind of things, but I think that law enforcement needs to get a little bit better in terms of focusing their energies in terms of what kinds of investigations they get involved in. And I've said this to the chief in my agency, that when a chief of police comes in and says, I want more arrests, well, as a police officer, that's pretty easy to do. I mean, I can go out and PC people all day long, but that does not equate necessarily into a good prosecutable case, because I've been around long enough to know what probable cause is, and I also know that may not be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not going to be sustained ultimately in a prosecution. But I would prefer that at some point we have some discussion statewide about how law enforcement agencies utilize their resources, and particularly as it relates to drug enforcement issues and prostitution and so on and so forth. I just think we can do a better job there.
Mr. Chair, if I may, members of the committee, my predecessor, Edwin Peterson, started a kind of an informal group with representatives of the District Attorneys and Association and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and in part, 4 or 5 years ago, at the urging of then-Senator Neil Bryant, we've more formalized it, and I have an advisory committee that's composed of district attorneys and defenders and judges, and I think a lay person or two court administrators, and I would second Mr. Ellis's support for a look at statewide, and I think this body here very well may be the one that can say who that ought to be and what they ought to do it. I've given, some people would suggest that the criminal justice system is an oxymoron, and if you see how it's built, in fact, if you went through the bills that you're faced with this session, you can kind of get a, as 30 years ago, I could attest, it's not built with any system in mind, and it happens.
Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many cases have been overturned on appeal because of poor defense over the last year, two, three, whatever?
I'm not sure I can answer that.
I don't think I can. Yes, I've had my hand in some of it. I think Senator Harper's looking at me. I frankly don't know. We could find out how many have been overturned, both in the Court of Appeals and in the Supreme Court, and you can find whether there was assigned error on the part of counsel. Where it shows up is primarily in post-conviction cases, and that's where the defendant is actually the plaintiff in a post-conviction case. A petitioner assigns error to whatever the trial lawyer did or the appellate lawyer, and that would be a more fruitful area to see how many of those are successful. I'm not sure we could find it. We did have testimony in front of the commission from Stephen Wax, who was the public defender. As you know, the system starts out with a trial in trial
federal,
court.
Federal.
But he testified in front of us that his concern is that when the cases get to the federal level under a habeas corpus side, well, they'll be reviewing not only the trial and appeal, but the post-conviction and appeal of that post-conviction, that there very well may be errors that will result federally requiring us to retry the individual. That's a vague answer, but I don't have the data to tell you how many are reversed because of incompetent counsel. And I'm not sure I could find out. I could look. But I'm not sure.
Just a simplistic metric to see whether the system is working, not working, or has some problems. But so we don't really know.
It becomes a cat chasing its tail a little bit. As long as the less than competent counsel is handling the case, you won't see these issues raised.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, I've been joined here by the Know All, See All, Explain All, Ann Christian, who is the director.
Thank you.
She may have an answer.
Thank you, Chief. Excuse me. Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, for the record, I have a horrible voice today, and I apologize for that, but for the record, my name is Ann Christian. I'm director of Indigent Defense Services Division, and it probably was six years ago where when Representative Parks asked exactly that same question, and we did some research and learned what I believe is still the case, that as far as success in post-conviction relief at the state level, less than 1% of convictions are overturned. There are not that many cases, however, filed as post-conviction relief. It's in the hundreds rather than the thousands. Generally, people who are incarcerated are the ones who file post-conviction relief. Most recently, we have been having death sentence cases get to the level where they're out of the appellate system and into the post-conviction relief area. Quite frankly, those are the ones, as an administrator, that I get most concerned about. And if my memory serves me correctly, there have been four death sentence cases at the trial level saying my attorney in the original case was ineffective. And until just about a month ago, none of those death sentences had been overturned. And maybe it's been 2 months now, but the Marion County Court did find in a Washington County 1992 aggravated murder trial that counsel was ineffective. My understanding is that the parties are trying to negotiate a settlement so that we don't go back and have to have a resentencing in that matter. But to answer your question, post-conviction relief cases are generally not successful.
So less than 1% in the aggregate. A little bit more perhaps than that.
Correct. 1% of the criminal caseload.
Parks and I both have the same DA, so I can see where that came from.
Another area. If I might, Mr. Chair, there was a recent post-conviction relief in Washington County where the court did overturn the conviction, and it was based on an area that's fairly recent and troubling, which is immigration and the impact of criminal conviction on a person's immigration status. And the court in Washington County ruled that the defense attorney was ineffective and that the attorney, and this is the difficulty we have, in that the attorney was not able to give that individual immigration legal advice, which creates a tension for us because we don't expect attorneys to be specialists in immigration.
Further complicated by the fact that there's a U.S. treaty, I understand that is an issue that we're going to be studying a little bit more in the interim this evening.
I think you have a bill here, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. All right.
Somewhere.
Senator Byer, you have a...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, if this thing was to go forward, Senate 145, and pass, currently these functions are all in two or three other places. So we see a corresponding cut in those budgets and a new budget for the we, the legislative body, would have to then approve, and then the following biennium would have a separate budget that we'd have to approve?
That's correct. I think the cost of the transition is four staff people that are already included in the request from the current Indigent Defense Administration. So the cost of the transition is not significant. It's I mean, everything is significant, but I think it's $500,000 for the total, if that explains it. A lot of this depends on whether we stay with the current cutover date of July 2002 or move, as you're going to hear from Ms. Christian, to a July 2003 date. If we do that, then you'd be on a new budget cycle.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, that we would delay this until the 2003-2005 biennium so we could incur the roll-up costs then, and they would be buried so we couldn't figure out what they are now. Is that kind of the idea?
Obviously, that would happen. I don't know if there are any roll-up costs or not. But
well, anytime we create a new agency, there's a roll-up cost.
Yeah, it might be interesting to at least have some fiscal analysis done based on starting it during this biennium to kind of root out some of those questions, because I don't think the intent is to increase the cost of indigent defense. If it is, then I guess we might have a different result of this body. But
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would certainly agree with the answer that you received from Mr. Ellis. I would add that it in only in conceptual terms, we would fold in the existing people and mechanism into one unit, and they would no longer exist in their present host, if you will. In other words, the state court administrator's function in the Indigent Defense Services Division would disappear, be folded in, and so would the Public Defender's Office be folded in. Now, the question about transition costs and costs, I think Ms. Christian is prepared to respond to that. Yeah, she will respond to the dollar exchange, but as far as, including bodies, but those two agencies will no longer exist should this become law, the two I mentioned.
Any additional? Okay. Mr. Shepard?
Thank you, Chair Menis and members of the committee. My name is Ross Shepard. I'm the Lane County Public Defender, and I'm the vice chair of this commission. And perhaps initially I'd like to report to you that the work of this commission has been laudable, and a lot of hard work's been put into it. There have been various versions of this commission idea in this state since 1989, and I would note there are probably 12 or 15 other states that have followed this model, already have implemented this model. So we're not right out at the tip of the arrow. But since 1989, when Bill Taylor and I took the first stab at drafting this legislation, the efforts have been rather ongoing. And to the extent I can, I wish to, I want to assure you that this bill is properly drafted, and that if you look favorably on the Dash 1 amendments, and if you make some decision about the implementation date of this commission, you can, this committee can rest well assured that the bill is in good form, has been given a lot of thought by a lot of different people, and if the commission idea seems to be appropriate to you, this is the bill to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard. Any questions? Mr. Chief Justice, thank you very much for your attendance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. And could we bring on the second wave?
Yes, sir.
We may. All right. Thank you.
It's going to wear us down.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Groom. I'm currently the director of the State Public Defender's Office. Our office does all of the criminal appeals, indigent criminal appeals for the state of Oregon, roughly 2,000 cases per year or 4,000 cases per biennium as a rough average. I'm not speaking on behalf. What I want to do is kind of try to answer some of the questions that have come up and to offer some opinions about what way this should go. I speak in support of this proposed legislation and of the system that that it supports. I'm a member of OCDLA, but I don't speak for OCDLA, and I just want to put on the record that the State Public Defender Committee, which oversees my office, has not taken a position on this particular bill, mostly because we haven't had a meeting lately, but otherwise I think they would have. I want to offer my office as kind of a model for what's trying to be attempted here. Currently, my office has an oversight committee, and this office has been in existence since the late 60s. It's a committee that currently consists of six people. Three or four of them are criminal defense lawyers. One is a former county counsel. One is a former legislator, and one is a professor of law, and this committee oversees the broad policy functions of my office. I'm in direct charge of the day-to-day operation, and I have oversight of quality and the efficiency of the system as well. And I believe that our office operates at peak efficiency for the appeals process. As I said, we have approximately 2,000 appeals a year that come into our office. Because we do this on a daily basis, we are able to find some efficiencies in the system that allow us to serve what I think the twin functions of the justice system are, or should be, which is fairness and efficiency. And I recognize that people may fall more one way or the other on the spectrum of fairness or efficiency, but I don't think those two particular goals work against each other. I think they work hand in hand. I think we are able to provide more fairness in our function because we are more efficient. We are probably not able to serve every client in our office exactly as that client wishes to be served. It's virtually impossible to do everything for everyone that they might want from their lawyer. However, I do think that what we are able to achieve is we are able to find a way to deal with the cases that we call frivolous or non-merit cases and to put our time and energy into cases which I think the entire system would like to see us putting our time into, cases where we really can have an impact on due process and on an individual's liberty interest, and maybe find that the person actually did not get a fair trial and deserves a fair trial. And really that should be the function of any criminal justice system. And in doing so, I think we do it in a way that is less costly to the system than it would be if we weren't there. If we weren't there, there would be 2,000 appeals dumped onto the appellate system. Ms. Christian or whoever was in the function of the indigent defense director would have to find attorneys. Probably over time, we'd cobble together some kind of contract system, kind of the way the whole indigent defense system works now. You find what works in various counties and go with that. And the same would be true with appeals if we weren't there. I suspect that, at least initially, if we weren't there, the cost of doing appeals in the state would double. And over time, the efficiency would bring it down a little bit. But our little budget's $5.7 million, and my figuring is that if an average appeal costs about $2,200 and we do 2,000 appeals, that's going to be about $9 million per biennium, and that's some $4 million over what our budget is. So I think we're more efficient than it would be without us in place. And I do think that over time, this Public Defense Services Commission could work the same way. It's in my mind, the purpose here is to do the right thing and to promote good government. And I think this bill would promote good government. The two areas that I see that are not being covered well right now, both in terms of fairness and efficiency, are two that Mr. Ellis alluded to, which is in the area of post-conviction relief, then the following appeals that come after that, and the death penalty. I think those two areas need more supervision by a centralized agency, by somebody who can provide training, training to the attorneys who do this kind of work. Because in the present system, there is no centralized training. There's no real look to the efficiencies of the functions that are being performed. And I think not only are the clients probably suffering, but I think the system is as well. And I think both of those could be handled in a better way that would really, I think, satisfy both sides of the fairness and efficiency equation. A state public defender could oversee the even distribution of resources and work to assure the effectiveness of the entire system. I think it's a bill that should be supported, and as Mr. Shepard said, it does seem to be the way that a number of states are going, and I think Oregon should go in that direction as well.
Questions? And who's going to talk about the Dash 1 amendments? You are? Okay. Go ahead, Ann.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record again, Ann Christian, the Director of Indigent Defense Services. And Mr. Chair, I did have passed out as Mr. Groom was testifying, a summary of Senate Bill 145, a one-page summary of Senate Bill 145 with the proposed Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments are not horribly substantive. They are the result of the most recent Public Defense Services Commission meeting held in March. And what I've done is attached to that one-page summary a hand-engrossed version of those sections of the original bill that would be amended by the proposed Dash 1 amendment. And if the chair would like, I can run through those very quickly.
Would you please?
On page 1, in the definitional section, section 1, the definition of director has simply been amended to indicate that the director means the Public Defense Services Executive Director. That may seem facial or superficial, but during the course of the commission meetings, there was much discussion about the absolute need for a strong, as many people put it, CEO for Indigent Defense or for Public Defense Services. And there was quite a bit of debate as far as whether or not the head person hired by the commission should be designated a state public defender, and the commission determined that the best term for this individual would be the Public Defense Services Executive Director. On page 2, the Chief Justice noted that he was, he did give some ground during the course of the commission meetings, that's for sure, and he understands and agrees with the fact, maybe a little bit begrudgingly, that the Chief Justice under this bill would be an ex officio non-voting member of the permanent commission. And as we were carefully reviewing the bill for the last time, there was an issue as far as whether or not the quorum, if the Chief Justice were present, whether he would be voted as a member for purposes of a quorum. So on line 14, on page two, we've tried to make it clear by saying a majority of the voting members constitutes a quorum to clear up that issue. On the same page, line 22, it was raised by a member that the original bill indicates that the commission would appoint the executive director and establish the compensation of the director. Actually, I have to admit I'm the one who brought this up. As far as what about the other individuals who would be employed by the commission? And so what has been changed with the -1 amendments is it is just indicated that the commission would adopt a compensation plan for the Public Defense Services Office commensurate with other state agencies, which Robin Lamont and Virginia Vanderbilt both agreed was the appropriate language. So that's inserted as a new subsection E, which makes the original subsection E adopt rules, which are rules that the commission would be required to adopt, makes that subsection F. For some unknown reason, quite frankly, Mr. Chair, some of the rules that the commission is required to adopt referenced existing rules of the state court administrator, the state public defender's office, and other entities, while others of them didn't. What we did just to clean up the bill is we took out references in sub A, sub B, sub D, and that's it to any rules that the rules would supersede. And with counsel's help, we put in on page three new language that simply says, as a matter of any of the rules, to the extent the commission adopts rules, any that are adopted by the commission supersede any of the old ones by the state public defender, the state court administrator, circuit courts, court of appeals, etc. On page three, we've also added, let me just orient here, this subsection three, which now becomes subsection four. We've clarified that the commission would not be in a position to interfere in any individual representation of a case. And then section four, what I've done is one of our members noticed that the manner in which section three, which details the responsibilities of the commission members, and section four, which details the responsibilities of the director, did not mirror each other. In other words, they didn't flow in the same fashion. And so attached to your handout is new page 3A is what the -1 amendment provides for the executive director. I can represent that none of these are substantive changes. They're reordering so that they generally tie with what the commission's responsibilities are in section three.
Okay.
There's two more.
Just a second. On page three, trying to figure out where the brackets are. Line 16, we're deleting all of the language from line 16 to line 45. Is that
correct? That's correct.
All right. And you're inserting the new language on 3A. Okay.
That's correct.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, then I believe there are only two more changes. Page six, and this relates to Senator Byers' concerns about fiscal. Page six, and it's line 35. When this commission would take over the responsibility for state public defender services and indigent defense services, as Ms. Lamont in legislative fiscal would say, there will be a divorce of sorts between the judicial department and the new commission. Currently, to give you some better background as far as the current system, judges and court staff are truly involved in the indigent defense function. And so today, as we sit here, there are court staff in every one of the state courts who are processing, for example, indigent defense billings. There also is central staff outside of my office who also processes those billings. But with regard to the transfer, the commission felt it was very important to amend the original bill. The original bill provided for the position authority to be transferred to the new commission, but the study commission felt it very important that the associated costs of those court staff also be shifted to the other side of the ledger, and that's the reason for the three-word amendment on page 6. And the final amendment on page 77 is just something that legislative counsel and I missed probably because it was toward the end of the bill. And what it provides is we've tried to be consistent, well, throughout the bill to term an individual who qualifies for indigent defense as being financially eligible, because that really is the standard that is used, rather than the word indigent. So on page 77, line 32, the word in existing law 151465 is amended, would be amended from the word indigent to financially eligible.
Chair. Senator Harper.
Could you tell me what that really means, Ann?
The financially eligible?
Yeah.
There is no intent whatsoever in this bill to change current law as far as financially eligible. Current law provides that a person is eligible or is indigent, is the current word used, is eligible for court-appointed counsel if hiring counsel for whatever type of charge would cause substantial hardship to the individual in providing basic necessities for that individual, in most cases the criminal defendant, and that defendant's dependent family. Okay, that's the statutory term. Now, how we put that into practice is with a two-prong test. We have currently only 35 court staff located locally within the court system to assist judges in deciding who is it who should be appointed counsel, because it certainly makes a difference whether or not an individual, the same individual, is before the court on a misdemeanor, a shoplifting charge, as opposed to aggravated murder or a Measure 11 offense. And so the two-prong test is this. The first determination is made, and it's based upon an affidavit that the defendant has to complete with financial information on assets, income, debts. And with a review of that affidavit, the court staff do the math as far as whether or not this person who's applying for counsel would qualify for food stamps. We've tied it to the federal food stamp level, which is 130% of the federal poverty line as a first determiner. If, in fact, and I believe a family of four, I sent that to you, Mr. Chair, I believe it's $24,000, but that's going strictly from memory. If the person would qualify for food stamps.
It's just the federal poverty
it is.
Level.
And we also have the second prong, which is just how much an attorney might charge if a person does have some assets. And what we use for that, Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, is the 25th percentile of what an attorney, based on surveys we conduct, would charge in that type of case. So, for example, if Mr. Groom were in private practice and if he and other defense attorneys responded that for a driving under the influence case, if I were to walk into his office and ask to retain him, Mr. Groom indicated that the retainer he would charge was $2,500. We would take 25% of that and say that is the retainer amount against which the judges and the court staff will determine whether or not to appoint counsel. So So we try to be conservative. Now, with that said, and this is not with any disrespect at all, with that said, there are two additional matters that need to be noted. The number of verification staff in the courts right now is inadequate, in my view. I used to be directly responsible for their supervision and am no longer, but with the strain otherwise on court resources as far as staff, we have seen in some counties, and I understand, I really do, the courts needing to use that, what we call verification staff, to handle other court matters that have to happen. The other thing worth noting, at least in my estimation, is that a judge, and again, I mean this with no disrespect, the reality is, especially in the larger courts, is when there is an arraignment of individuals going on, and everyone's in the courtroom, there is a tendency to want to move those cases, not only by the judge, but by the district attorney. And I know in Multnomah County, our verifiers, you know, really work hard to try to keep up. But I think when there's a tendency that if there's a question, someone's on the line, rather than set over the case, which is what we recommend, for 2 weeks for the person to go out and either contact the Oregon State Bar Modest Means Program, which they have and pays attorneys, I believe it's up to $60 per hour. The individual, rather, pays the attorney only $60 per hour. Rather than set it over for 2 weeks, some judges don't want to do that, and frankly, some prosecutors don't want to. So this is an area where I really do think, because you need to know concrete areas, where I really do think improvements can be made as far as efficiency and actual savings in indigent defense. But it's a matter of staffing.
Really long answer to what I thought was a fairly simple question.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Senator Harper.
Is there, like other programs, is there a spend-down requirement for their assets?
Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, I'll try to be briefer. There is, in that the court looks at the assets, and one of the things we did last session is got legislation that allows a person who's retained counsel, so they use their assets. The court says, you've got enough assets in the court's opinion to hire counsel, but then, or outside relatives retain counsel, but then they run out of money. And this happened, where they retain counsel and then their assets and their income do not allow them to continue, rather than have a situation where that retained attorney withdraws and the state winds up paying for court-appointed counsel as well as the expenses. The courts do allow, in some limited cases, for indigent defense to be used for those non-attorney costs. So I can't speak for every one of the 36 counties, but it's my belief that assets, at least under our policy for verification, are scrutinized. And, for example, credit card, credit availability is looked at as whether or not a person is able to retain counsel.
Thank you.
Questions,
Mr. Senator Courtney? I'll go along with what you want to do here. I'm a little, I look at how you get on the commission, and it's filled with knots. And I don't know. I don't blame you. In deference to Senator Beyer, he'll love this. You want to, you at least don't want two of them to be members of the bar, and I understand that. Let's kick the lawyers, so let's beat the hell out of them. That's fine with me. But everything else is a knot. You can't be a current judge. You can't be a prosecutor. You can't be a criminal defense attorney if you get more than 50% of your income. Not. I don't know. I just think that you may find there's so many knots in there that you might wish you hadn't done that, because I got a feeling there are judges out there. There are prosecutors out there. There are who really would love to be on this thing, who worked their tails off and could bring a great deal of objectivity and expertise. So do what you want, but you've executed a whole lot of people who probably know this area, could work hard in this area and be good, but you've disqualified them because they are a judge, or they're a prosecuting attorney, or they're a criminal defense attorney, or they're a law enforcement person. So we wiped out all those people.
Oh, no.
And, you know, with day in, day out, we sit here listening to people who make their who work in those areas in our state and our civilization do a remarkable job. And the fact that they presently are there, I think they could make a remarkable commission member, do a great job, put their heart and soul into it. But that's okay. I'll do whatever you want to do. I just, the knots, everything's a knot in there. Not, no, 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 no. We're taking care of the lawyers. We don't want to get rid of those guys. We don't want them. We don't want them. So I don't know. I'm happy for you doing it, but make me feel bad for anybody in law, anybody who today's a cop, anybody who's sitting on the bench, any deputy DA, we don't want you. We don't want you in this area. You're worthless. And by the way, if you're a criminal defense attorney, you make just a little too much money at this business, we don't want you either. So I'm happy for you, so go ahead. Just a little comment, Mr. It reads like you're bad, you're bad, you're bad, you're bad, you're bad. Don't read it. If you're ready.
Kind of like a turn in this thing.
Yeah, well, same way. So I don't know why you did that, or who went into that, or who did all those disqualifying, or where that came from, but I don't know. I don't know.
Well, what was the rationale?
Mr. Chair, I would tell you that this section was one of the most discussed sections as far as excluding and including and that type of issue that you've identified, and there were concerns exactly as you have raised that were raised by members, and it was a consensus group that I think will be interested when we meet in a couple of weeks to hear the concern. Personally, I think it fits in with what the chair indicated earlier when Barnes Ellis and the chief were up here as far as getting a group together to work together. Who would you put on that group? I think you would put, and this is my personal opinion as opposed to the commission's opinion, you would put people who are very experienced and who have done the work that is being examined with the addition of many other people who have good ideas, but I understand your concern.
I'm not concerned. I think it's good to kick them out.
You can imagine the discussion, and it was...
Make sure we have a lot of old retired pilots in the plane, cockpits, or flying suits. If I got that's who I want landing in the middle of a storm, but if there's any current knowledge, it might, you know, what the heck, plane might land right. Get them old retired decaying pilots, baby.
Whatever gets you there.
Yeah, they sure will.
All right. Before the committee gets completely out of hand. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, I've submitted written testimony, and there's no way I'm going to read it. But at the end of the testimony, toward the end of it, I do, and this is in my role as the current administrator of the Indigent Defense Services Division, I do need to just raise a concern that, again, will fit in with Senator Beyer's concern. Raise a concern with the bill as currently drafted, even with the proposed 1-1 amendments. The date on which the State Public Defender's Office, my office, and the total responsibility for indigent defense would actually transfer is July 1, 2002 in this bill. And perhaps in part it's because I just experienced, I have a staff of 7 individuals, and we just had one staff person who we knew was pregnant but wound up having the baby 2.5 months early. It's making me realize more and more so that a transition in order to do the job completely and well in meshing the two systems together and to really get some of the infrastructure established, our accounting system for indigent defense is 14 years old. My bottom line is that I'm concerned that the transfer date in the current bill is too soon. I'm not asking, Mr. Chair, I'm not asking the committee to hold the bill up for an amendment because there's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. But my staff and I are very much concerned about whether or not a July 1, 2002 transfer date would work efficiently and well. It's not a matter, I think there was an illusion that the fiscal impact would be less, therefore that's why I'm advocating it. I'm frankly just saying that the seven staff and I and Mr. Groom's office, I think, need a longer transition period to deal with the transition rather than loading up a fiscal impact statement, which I could, that says in order to accomplish what is being expected under Senate Bill 145, we'll have to bring in the national experts on indigent defense. I don't think that that's the right way to go. So
can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want the bill or not?
I do.
Okay. So
I strongly support it.
I know, but see, I think Senator Beyer's concern's a good one. I mean, you know, you can do the administrative thing and load it up with costs and whatever else, and, you know, send it to Ways and Means. They look at it and go, they'll kill it down there as opposed to us not moving on it here. But, I mean, if it's a good idea, it seems to me that a year, 14 months, is sufficient time to do planning. I mean, I think we required the State Office for Services to Children and Families to become the State Office for Services to Children and Families in about that same period of time. And they've got 3,000-plus employees and transitioned their function. So, I mean, I have to kind of depend on you because, you know, y'all wrote the thing. You know, you guys have made these decisions about where you want to go. I have personally no vested interest one way or the other. But I also don't want to end up with some substantial roll-up cost in the next biennium.
No.
Because although I'm term limited, I have to suffer through that too, unless God should take me from this earth. I'm not sure if I'm praying in favor of that or not. But it's a concern. So I mean, the question to you and everyone is, do you want the bill? And if so, can you do it? If you can't do it, then let us know. We'll kill the thing here and move on.
Mr. Chair, I do want the bill.
Yeah. I've got kind of a throwing the luggage off the airplanes mentality in this particular session, so kind of, it's up to y'all. Okay. Any further questions? Senator Butter?
Maybe you already addressed it without the room. I apologize, but there was one on page 77. There was two of the replacing the indigent. Did you get both of those? Your handed gross version doesn't have that.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to appreciate Senator Byers. On page 77, you're saying there were two?
The LC version that I must have replacing indigent on both line 32 and line 37.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Beyer, I missed the second one. Thank you.
You missed the second one?
I failed to include the deletion.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
I apologize.
That's okay. Okay. Now, Ingrid's going to speak in opposition to this, I think, so we'll drag her up and have her comment.
You can only tie the lip line record.
Almost 100% so far.
Close, isn't it? Good afternoon, Your Honor. Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I wanted to present a written statement from Bob Funnell, who's the president of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And then I wanted to introduce Dave Audette, who is a member of the board of directors of our Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Dave practices in Hillsborough. He's in private practice and has many years of experience as a criminal defense practitioner.
He's disqualified.
That's right. I would not qualify to be on the commission. But anyway, as a board member, I want to let this committee know that we greatly appreciate the opportunity we've had to participate in this commission. And we really want indigent defense to improve. That's one of the major goals of our whole organization, and it needs to improve. And there's many things we like about the bill, but we decline to support the bill because there's really no assurance of adequate funding. Now, inadequate funding only allows some of the current problems to worsen. And I know this is not the Ways and Means Committee, but as a private practitioner, who sometimes accepts indigent defense cases, sometimes gets paid to represent people who are accused of crimes. I really believe every person accused of a crime or having juvenile court problems through some of the growing areas in indigent work, has a right to competent, experienced representation. I often get frustrated. I cannot continue, I can't really subsidize the indigent defense system. I do. I accept a number of indigent cases and the $40 an hour rate, which hasn't changed in over a decade, but frankly, it doesn't even pay my overhead. I don't have an expensive office in Hillsboro. It's a small house. We have employees, nothing extravagant, but still, $40 an hour just will not do that. And it's frustrating to me because I'm watching the decreasing quality of criminal defense work. Nobody cares. I see attorneys working out of their briefcases, out of their cars, using cell phones. These are attorneys who have little or no contact with their clients. They show up in court, and instantly problems happen. The court hearings don't happen. They get new lawyers. The lawyers aren't ready. The clients aren't willing to go ahead. Overburdened public defenders, the exact same problem. I also work in the federal court system, and I take some court-appointed cases there also. They've recently increased their wages to $75 an hour plus expenses, and I can say that does cover my overhead. Not going to get rich at it, but it pays the overhead, and I'm glad to do that. We talked a little bit about federal habeas corpus. This is one of the places where all the inadequate representations end up out of state court, not all of them, but some of them. And the Federal Public Defender's Office, Steve Wax, I think, mentioned some testimony there. They have an increasing number of those cases, I can say. They can't handle them all. They've been asking private practitioners such as myself to accept those, and I've just chosen not to accept those. I also remember the 1985 effort at the Indigent Defense Commission, and it's kind of left a real leery feeling in my heart. And the funding was minimal in that case. The commission was a disaster. The court system had to take all this case back and had to redo the whole thing all over again with an incredible added expense. I hear Ann Christian when she says that she's supporting maybe a delayed implementation. I think something else, and that's supported by OCDLA, if this committee was to accept this bill. Also, I think another good thing nobody's mentioned is there is a sunset clause, 2005. So if it doesn't work, quickly get out of it. But with adequate funding, there's a lot to like about that. But right now, we just don't have that assurance. So once again, we decline to support the bill.
Are there any questions, comments, or concerns about what has just been said to us about no money? Thank you. Ingrid, do you have anything more to say except nothing. You're just against it because that's what you're against?
That's the position of our organization.
Thank you very much, Ingrid, for being against it. All right. All right, Diane Stewart, please come forward. Representative Kevin Mannix, Senator Kevin Mannix, come forward, please. This is going to be good. Kevin, you're going second.
That's why I'm sitting in the second chair, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Courtney, members of the committee, my name is Diana Stewart, and actually I'm here in somewhat of a neutral position. I have served on the Oregon State Bar Indigent Defense Task Force 3, and I've handed you all out a copy of the report and the recommendations that were made to the Oregon State Bar by that task force, which conducted its business for over a two-year period of time. It is now being, that report was adopted by the Oregon State Bar earlier this year and has now been sent to the Judicial Administration Committee, where I was foolish enough to volunteer, and somehow my membership on the committee may have gotten me, or on the task force may have gotten me on that committee, because the task force report is with me now in front of the Judicial Administration Committee. We have not yet taken a position. We have not yet met on the current bill before you. However, I'm here today to give you some information from the task force report, which did spend the last 2 years looking at quality of indigent defense services throughout the state of Oregon as part of the charge given to us by the Oregon State Bar. The specific charge on the task force was to examine by geographic area throughout the state questions of whether quality of services was being delivered, and to review this question by type of provider, by type of case, and as I said, by geographic area. Just to give you a little background quickly on how this report was put together, the task force quickly realized that we didn't have the ability to do a statistically valid kind of statistic interview process. And frankly, we weren't sure because everyone is so busy that we would get back an adequate number of responses to a questionnaire. So instead, we decided to do a face-to-face interview throughout the state with as many people as we possibly could, covering a broad enough spectrum of people to try to get all kinds of opinions. And with the members of the task force, we divided the entire state by geographic area. We got lists of the current indigent defense providers in geographic area from Ms. Christian's office and went through those lists attempting to get heads of office as well as staff people in offices as well as small providers as well as public defender offices, judges, district attorneys in each of the geographic areas. We ended up doing face-to-face interviews with 200 people and then bringing the results back to try to put together this task force report, which I believe gives us the best sense of what's going on throughout the state of Oregon right now with indigent defense services. The one common thread, which you might expect throughout the state, was that it's impossible to do the job that the system is required to do with the funding that's currently available for it. And that was the common theme in large geographic areas and remote geographic areas. Remote geographic areas and large populated areas. The larger counties, however, had some distinct problems that were different from the more remote geographic areas. The larger counties had the problems of large offices, largely staffed by inexperienced lawyers, who are handling the lower level offenses, as you might expect, the misdemeanors, drug offenses, traffic offenses. But they were losing their lawyers at a rapid turnover, so that offices could almost be decimated by losing the people that they were intending to move into the more experienced levels before they could get them to that point where they had the training and the experience to be able to take on more serious offenses. And in effect, what we saw was that the age, I'm starting to feel old now, but the age of the more experienced defenders was getting increasingly higher and higher in those counties, with the offices concerned about what was happening because they didn't have that middle echelon of experience coming up. Younger lawyers were coming out of law schools with huge bills and debts and unable to continue to work at the level of pay that they were being paid. And so offices were seeing a large turnover of their lawyers. In the more remote areas, the problem that we saw was that the level of funding prevented people from being able to get the training and expertise in a broad range of kinds of cases. So when a more unique or difficult case came their way, there was difficulty with the providers being able to find someone who was experienced and competent to be able to handle that kind of unique or difficult case. Training was a difficulty. Peer sort of support was difficulty, And universally throughout the state, even with experienced defenders, the theme that we heard over and over again was that because the rate of compensation was so low, more and more cases were having to be contracted for, and the volume of people's caseloads was overwhelming the ability to carefully analyze, to research, to investigate, and to prepare for hearings. One thing that we discovered to our dismay was that there was no statewide mechanism of monitoring quality of services. And just as the question, I think it was Senator Harper asked earlier, well, can't we be assured that with post-conviction relief and habeas corpus that we have some benchmarks that things are going pretty well? That, too, was the common theme throughout the state among people in the system who had nothing to do with post-conviction and habeas corpus. But instead, when we reached those areas, and the reason this happens is that post-convictions happen in the counties where the prisons are located. And so as we locate our prisons in geographically more remote areas, that's where the local group of lawyers ends up receiving these cases and increasingly are unwilling to take these cases. The one interesting thing about, one of the many disturbing things about post-conviction cases is that, in fact, they are funded at a lower rate in reality than most other cases are funded, even though they are more complex and require more investigation and more analysis and inevitably go to trial. And the reason for that is that they're still contracted out in a large group. But unlike other kinds of criminal cases, these cases don't plead out. These cases don't get resolved short of trial, and most of them, as I said, go to hearing, and therefore leave the people who are willing to take these cases with woefully inadequate compensation, which results in virtually no investigation and a very low level of competent representation in these cases. So you see the ironic situation of hoping that your safeguard for competent representation is often being handled by a person who may not be competently handling that safeguard. The other, I don't want to go through this report for you item by item, but the other sort of generic areas that the task force saw problems with is that in addition to post-conviction habeas corpus, the indigent defense system handles civil commitment hearings, and throughout the state there, that's a lack of resource, a lack of skilled lawyers available to handle those kinds of unique cases. Additionally, we saw as the juvenile system is mushrooming that there's more and more of a recognition that the way that we've treated dependency cases, but especially termination of parental rights cases, has created a problem statewide with fewer and fewer lawyers being willing to handle those kinds of cases because of their complexity, because of the length of those kinds of cases, and because of the fact that, of course, they involve one of the most fundamental of all rights, the loss of one's children. The task force concluded by saying that we have problems in delivering services statewide, that we, one of the main conclusions of the task force was that if the legislature were to give the task force an unlimited amount of money, we would probably start looking at centralizing throughout the state services for indigent defense because of the efficiencies that can occur with training, because of the efficiencies that can occur with having a group, a core of experienced lawyers who can go out and assist the lawyers in more geographically remote areas when there's a case of particular complexity or difficulty. Obviously, that's not going to happen. So the task force looked to what can we start to do with a recognition that we need to start to centralize services a bit more? Where are the beginning steps where that can occur? And we made a series of recommendations to the Oregon State Bar of goals and specific recommendations, small concrete recommendations that we hope the bar would start actually trying to implement.
Mr. Chair?
Gentlemen.
I have a quick question. I'm confused. You're taking a neutral stand, right? And yet you're opposed. Do I get the feeling you're opposed to many of the things in here?
No, actually, I'm not. And I'm sorry if I've confused you. The conclusion of the Indigent Defense Task Force was let's start looking at being more central. And
Mr. Chair, if I could. So technically, you don't care whether we pass this or not pass it today.
The task force itself has not taken a position on this bill. No, because we have now concluded our service to the bar. The Oregon State Bar Judicial Administration Committee, on which I serve, has not yet taken a position on this bill. What I have attempted to present today was the conclusions of the task force in showing you that there are, in effect, many things about the task force report that fits in with this bill. This bill appears to be attempting to centralize administration at this point, and many of the results, and this was done without any awareness of this bill. The task force conclusions were reached without any awareness of this bill's existence because it was before the bill was introduced, and in fact was not involved in any way with the commission's service. So the conclusions of the task force are remarkably seem to head in much of the same direction as the commission has headed.
Okay, okay. And now I'm glad I asked the question.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Beginning to worry.
Yeah. So I would commend to the committee the recommendations and goals of this task force, which goals 3 through 7 look to the future need to try to put mechanisms in place in which we can centralize services, in particular training services, centralized support for geographically remote areas, resource and assistance offices, much like the Attorney General's office provides to state agencies and entities throughout the state, statewide post-conviction and habeas services that can be done statewide, and statewide litigation support, both in civil commitments, in parental terminations, in delinquency and dependency cases. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Stewart. The Honorable Kevin Mannix, please, your statement for the record.
Men there, excuse me, I'm Kevin Mannix from Salem. I'm appearing on behalf of myself. Been there, done that is my response. We've been talking about changing the methodology for putting together the indigent defense system in the state for years. In the 1999 session, we had a proposal to just do it. And at that time, it was, oh, no, we need to study this, and we need more time, and let's gather all the data, and let's get some certified smart people, to use a phrase that Senator Courtney likes to use, and let's have them study this and come back to the next session with a recommendation. So we did that. We got the certified smart people together. They did a great job. Great report. Great bill. By the way, that's different from the Barr Task Force. I hope you noticed. They have their own little study, but that's an inside thing by the Barr and the indigent defense people. I'm talking about the Public Defense Services Commission, the group that we established, brought in all the certified smart people. They worked really hard. They even listened to me once. They called me in to testify. And since I was the sponsor of the original bill, I felt real good about it. And then they came out with a great report, and I couldn't even criticize it. I felt that ambivalent. There must be something here to criticize. Then it came up with a great bill and some good amendments. I think the Dash 1 amendments are okay. The only thing I don't like is the sunset clause. I think it ought to be moved back a little bit, but no, leave it alone. That makes everybody comfortable. This is a good bill, and it makes progress because it takes judges out of the direct loop about decision-making on indigent defense. It still leaves it in the judicial branch for those who are afraid that the mean and nasty executive branch won't be sensitive enough to indigent defense. It allows an opportunity to do all the great things the Barr talks about to reform the system. Allows that opportunity, pulls things together, makes things more rational and coordinated. It's a good bill. I think it's just great, and I wish I could spend half an hour criticizing it. But I have nothing further to say, Mr. Chairman.
You're done. Okay.
Open work session.
Open work session on Senate Bill.
Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 145.
All right. Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 145.
For discussion?
Do I have a fiscal in here any place?
Any objection? No, but it does have a subsequent to Ways and Means.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
It goes there. Any further discussion? If not,
motion passed. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 145 as a matter of the Ways and Means Committee.
All right, Senator Courtney moves. Senate Bill 145 is amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objection? None. So ordered. And as far as the fiscal, I mean, I would consider if the subcommittee and the co-chairs of Ways and Means want to change the implementation date to change that fiscal. I mean, to me, that's really a fiscal question. If they need a letter or something in terms of the committee's desire, we can kind of talk about that here. If they do want to change it, we can bring that issue back to the committee and chat about what the fiscal implications are, and I think maybe we should have that. We'd like to have at least some idea of what that fiscal impact is. We'll try to work or coordinate with this committee. All right. We've got a work session on Senate Bill 654.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Senate Bill 654 was originally before you on March 12th. This is the bill, as amended by the Dash 2 amendments, that allows police officers to obtain a body wire to record suspect statements without a court order. You have the Dash 2 amendments before you, and you have a hand-engrossed bill that Enola prepared for you. And real quickly, I can run through. It allows an officer to obtain a body wire without a court order if he has probable cause to believe that the person is committing a drug or prostitution crime. Allows an officer to use a body wire without a court order if he's investigating a felony. and there are what are known as exigent circumstances, emergency circumstances. Requires the officer to record the statements in their entirety, requires the officer to maintain confidentiality regarding the recorded statements. Bill allows a judge to grant an order permitting officer to use a telephone wiretap to investigate a prostitution case, and also provides that an officer has defense to any civil or criminal action if the officer obtains recording with a good faith reliance on statutory authority. And lastly, the bill would, the last portion, it would not hold inadmissible evidence that was taken without a court order, just solely because it did not follow ORS 133724, the Oregon and Supreme Court, Oregon and United States constitutions, of course, would still be in effect, governing whether any evidence obtained is admissible.
All right. Now, the objective, if I understand correctly, is to try to segregate the various statutes that dealt with both body wire and ex parte orders for wiretap, and to try to make some clarity or give clarity to those two separate, at least what the legislature originally thought were separate areas that the Fleetwood case tended to blend together and I guess point out our flaws in construction of statutes. So that's where we are. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If staff could just explain one thing to me. On page 5 of your Hannon Gross edition, we just mentioned the exigency. Other, we have the prostitution drug or other. Could you just explain what those circumstances might be that would be in addition to?
Yes, Senator Metzger, Mr. Chairman and members, an exigency, to explain what that would mean, is that what your question is?
In layman's terms, what other things might this then cover where they don't have to get a court order besides the prostitution and drug things articulated here?
Yeah, thank you. As Mr. Senator Metzger, we heard testimony, you'll recall, from Officer Wheat, March 12th. She was investigating a murder that happened in Portland, known as the Forest Park murder. She was actually acting as a prostitution decoy, but investigating a murder. Mm-hmm. This would apply to any felony where there's an emergency situation. The officers would be able to record statements. Typically, that's a situation, for example, when you have a confidential informant that is using a wire to help with officer safety. Other officers can be monitoring that wire. Would help with an investigation like that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Burdick.
As I understand this, and I apologize for being out of the room, I was actually discussing this in the hallway, but as I understand it, this would reinstate the law as we thought it was before the court case, and the reason that it's a series of amendments is because the court case unfolded after the original bill was introduced.
Actually, Senator Courtney and I were on the committee in 1989 that wrote that law, and we thought we were being perfectly clear back then. Apparently, that wasn't the case, and the court disagreed with us. And I think if you read the Fleetwood case, it's confusing even to certified smart criminal lawyers and prosecutors and defense attorneys together. But I think the intent of the legislature at the time was to allow for the wiretap, the body wire issue under very limited certain circumstances, which was officer safety, prostitution, drug issues and stuff, or exigency, where there wasn't necessarily time to get a specific warrant. And then we had the ex parte wiretap order, which I think was modeled after the federal statutes, if I'm not mistaken, for getting a wiretap order, where you had, time that you could take and put together an affidavit, go to a judge, present it to the judge, and have them sign that and then go about doing the installation of listening devices or tapping of telephones and so on and so forth. So that was the intent. As I recall back in 1989, I think what we're trying to do here is codify that but make clearer the statutes. And I think the court, in essence, felt that it was not written very clearly. And I think this committee heard Justice Carson in a previous conversation talk about if we want to write a law, we need to write it and make it clear in terms of what we say. So apparently they didn't feel like we did that in the past. So,
follow up, as I understand it, this would put body wires in much the same status as taped telephone conversations where you have the consent of one party but not the other party.
Mr. Chairman, if I can answer that, what it does is it puts the body wire again. An officer could ask for a court order under 133726. It would allow an officer who is listening to a telephone conversation, if he's listening to one person, and I don't mean with a listening device, but for example, in the room, this measure has what would term that an utterance, meaning if the body wire picks up one end of a phone conversation, that's admissible, and it would characterize that as an utterance rather than a wire communication.
Right. Actually, what I was trying to say is if somebody calls you on the phone and you tape that conversation, then that's legal under Oregon law, correct, even if right. you don't tell them?
Correct. Because one party, Mr. Chairman, because one party is consenting.
Consent. So this would put body wires in that same type of category. I mean, the person wearing the body wire has consented to the
I see what you're taping. Saying. Mr. Chairman, I think that's true in one sense, yes. If the officer is engaging in a conversation and wearing a body wire, the officer or someone that he directs as an, you know, for example, an undercover officer or an undercover informant, that is true. If that person is engaging in the conversation, it would be lawful. I'm not sure that it doesn't get there for the same reasons as the decisions that have made that lawful for a telephone communication, but that would be a recording that could be used. And so does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it was a while since the hearing, and I just I had some concerns, and our good district attorney from Marion County straightened me out in the hallway, and you finished the job, so I think I'm okay.
Were you taking the conversation?
Mr. Chairman, I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 654.
Senator Courtney moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 654. Discussion. Objections. Hearing none.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 654 as amended to Senate floor to be passed recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 654 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. We have the public hearing on Senate Bill 80.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I am Christian, Indigent Defense Services Division Director. This will be much briefer than Senate Bill 145, and I appreciate the Chair's indulgence and committee members' indulgence for what we think is a very important bill, Senate Bill 145. And I do want to quickly acknowledge one of our commission members who is still here with us, who is longtime Representative Mary Burroughs. And Mary has been a joy to work with on the commission, and I just would like to indicate that she has brought a lot of background from her legislative days, and also what I've enjoyed is the fresh look by a person who is outside the criminal justice system, and I just wanted to acknowledge her presence today.
Senator Courtney is
she's a former state legislator, right?
That's my
understanding. Qualifies to do to have that expertise.
I believe so.
Okay, thank you. I just want to be sure that we understood that.
She is not a nut.
She's not an act. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Actually, Mary, you're not term limited, are you?
No.
You could actually run again. You could come back, though, if you chose.
Absolutely.
All right. All right, go ahead, Ann.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 80 is a companion bill, I'll say, to Senate Bill 145. It would extend the sunset of the current Public Defense Services Commission Study Commission. The Judicial Department respectfully requests that you take favorable action on Senate Bill 80 so that it tracks. It has a subsequent referral as well to Ways and Means, so it tracks along with Senate Bill 145. With that said, I just want to correct for the record that Senate Bill 145, which would make the change that I appreciate former Representative Mannix endorsing, does not have a sunset. Senate Bill 145 does not have a sunset. and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any work session, Mr. Chair?
No, but we can be. Anybody want to go to work session?
Yep.
Okay, work session, Senator.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 180 for the Ways and Means Committee.
80.
Excuse me, Senate Bill 80. I'm sorry. I apologize.
All right. Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 80, unamended, to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion. Any objection? Hearing none. No order. And that concludes our business for today. Now, Senator Burdick, you were absent on one vote. Senate Bill 145, do you want to vote on that?
Yes.
All right. Senator Courtney moves we suspend the rules for the purpose of Senator Burdick voting on Senate Bill 145. Any objections? No order. Senator Burdick votes yes on Senate Bill 145.
You got to move to suspend the rules. Then you got to move
He asked for any objection. There was no objection.
Right. Then you have to move. I hate to be technical. That Senator Burdick be allowed to vote on.
Okay.
You have to make that official move in order for unanimous consent to allow her to vote after you move to suspend rules. You can do what you want. I'm not telling you.
Senator Courtney moves for unanimous consent to allow Senator Burdick to vote on Senate Bill 145. No, we already suspended
the rules.
Okay.
Is there any objection to unanimous consent? None.
Senator Burdick
was
very great guilt,
but
yes.
All right. Everybody votes yes.
We're adjourned.
We should have a lot of guilt.